With no fees or minimums, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision in the history of decisions. Even easier than deciding to listen to another episode of your favorite podcast. And with no overdraft fees, is it even a decision? That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. Member FDIC. Credit scores, down payments, interest rates. Car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelly Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. Crunch your numbers and get personalized results so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. It's like having a magic wand for your wallet. Presto! The car you've been wanting is now within reach. So hit the road and leave your calculator at home. AutoTrader. Hey everybody! You may not know this yet, and if you don't, prepare to be blown away. We are creating right now the first ever Stuff You Should Know book. It's called Stuff You Should Know, : an incomplete compendium of mostly interesting things. And you can pre-order it now.
That's right. And if you pre-order, everyone, there's an incentive because you get a free gift. And don't worry if you've already pre-ordered, because you can just head on over to stuffyoushouldreadbooks.com. It's a very beautiful little webpage, and it's got all the information. And if you've already pre-ordered, can't you just like upload your receipt and get that pre-order gift?
Yep, you can. And they will mail it off to you and you will get it in the mail and you say, oh, thank you. Don't mind if I do. And it's a poster that you will love and cherish and possibly pass on down to your children as an heirloom.
That's right, everyone. We couldn't be more excited about this book. It's really coming together well. It's us through and through. And you can go check out some excerpts at stuffyoushouldreadbooks.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. We are comrades in arms here at SYSK. Stuff You Should Know.
Let me ask you something.
Okay.
When you were researching this and thinking in your brain about talking about it, did you get nervous?
No.
Okay.
I guess you did.
A little bit.
What were you nervous about?
Talking about the friggin' KGB.
Yeah.
Oh, and how they just kill anyone that they don't like.
Oh, okay. Now, you know, I got the most nervous ever when we recorded on Delta Force.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I was really nervous.
You think they're going to come kill you?
I don't know. I mean, they're not supposed to exist, and we were talking about how they do exist, so I was like, surely not. But no, I know what you're talking about. It didn't happen in this one, so maybe this is the one that'll get me.
Because KGB, you know, those are the, and it even says in this article, like, when you think about the knock on your door in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. come with us, that's KGB ops right there.
Right. But that was if you were a Russian, a Soviet citizen. Which is
it's true.
It's weird because, like, you know all about the KGB just having been raised as a Cold War kid, you know? But I never really put two and two together that it was a really all-encompassing secret police kind of thing that they had going on, because not only were they big on spying and getting their hands on advanced weapon technology and running disinformation campaigns around the world and trying to destabilize the United States and its reach around the world, they also were really focused internally and domestically as well, so that they were a secret police force that would come and get dissenters and send them off to prison camps in the middle of the night. They basically did it all, and all of it was geared, Chuck, toward keeping the Soviet Communist Party in power. And they were successful for several decades, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, from reading this research, it seems like, I mean, they did do all the things, but their main charge was squashing from within, it seems like.
Squishing your head from within.
So KGB stands for, I'm going to try and read this.
Lay it on me. Russian.
Komitet, that's easy, mm-hmm. with a K.
Yeah.
Gosudarstvennoy. Bisopasnosti.
It sounds like you just raised like an Aramaic demon.
Klatu Varata. So that means in English, Committee for State Security. Mm-hmm. They were headquartered, and we're going to say were a lot because technically the KGB itself is not around anymore. It's just been renamed, though. So right. Same stuff going on, same place. They were and are now headquartered under the FSB at Lubyanka Square mm-hmm. in Moscow.
Which is where the KGB was, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's where the headquarters was and still is.
Right.
And it's this big, you know, beautiful sort of intimidating building right there in the square.
And, I mean, that's just par for the course. The KGB has basically been this entity that's changed names and official titles multiple times since the very beginning of the USSR. But it's still the same thing. And it's actually really instructive to study it because it seems that they are still very much up to the exact same things that they've been doing for decades now. And everybody very famously is well aware of the GRU, which is military intelligence. But it seems that the GRU, the FSB, and another group called the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, are all basically like the KGB. It's just now been divided into separate entities, but they're all working together. But after the 2016 election, everybody got a pretty obvious taste of what the KGB has long been up to, which is trying to meddle in American politics and trying to sow discord among Americans ourselves. This is nothing new, apparently. They've been doing it since the outset. Actually, since after World War II, at least.
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing this. If you talk about sowing discord, there was Operation Pandora in the 1960s, which was basically the Soviets trying to start a race war within the U.S., infiltrating groups like the Klan, the Jewish Defense League, and the African-American militants, posing as them, making fake pamphlets from the different organizations and blasting those out to basically try and start a race war. It didn't work, but it did create discord. They've also posed as people from Antifa and Black Lives Matter, and they're still doing the same thing today.
Yeah, except now they're doing it in this hyper-accelerated manner because things can spread so much more quickly on social media, and you can turn so many people's opinions on social media so much more quickly as well. So there doesn't seem to be officially any disagreement that the Russians meddle in American affairs. And I have long been like, well, you know, it doesn't excuse it, but, you know, we can't ignore the fact that America meddles in other countries' affairs too and has for a very long time too. And that is definitely instructive also and something to pay attention to. But first of all, it's a whataboutism. But secondly, from what I read, there's this scholar who wrote this really, really interesting article in the Brown Journal of Public Affairs, I believe is what it was called. The Brown Journal of World Affairs. A guy named Calder Walton wrote this this article on the KGB and its disinformation campaigns. Super readable, really exciting kind of. But he basically says, yes, America has done some very, very shady stuff in the affairs of other countries and in its own affairs too, like, you know, the CIA dosing Americans with LSD to see what happens kind of thing. The Americans and the Brits' operations just pale in scope and breadth compared to what the KGB has done and what it seems like the FSB is now still doing right now.
Yeah, not nice guys.
So I just want to shout out that article. It's called Spies, Election Meddling, and Disinformation, Past and Present. You should check it out.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look into the KGB and spying and espionage, there are so many great articles and documentaries on YouTube that you can watch. Some a little more fun than others, some very dry. The BBC has a two-parter on the KGB that's very dry but very instructive. Mm-hmm. So the KGB, if you want to talk about that organization, you got to go back to pre-KGB in December 1917 when Lenin created a secret police agency called the Cheka, Cheka. They were the punishing sword of the revolution is what they were known as. And this was basically the, like you said, it's gone under many names. It was the KGB before it was called the KGB. It was there to keep leadership in power, imprisoning, killing opponents both abroad and within the country, mm-hmm. keeping people under surveillance, censoring news, and basically starting the espionage program on foreign soils.
Yep. The Cheka was followed by the OGPU, then the KGB, then the FSB/SVR. But from that moment, the Cheka was formed till today. There has been a steady, continuous, basically unbroken security apparatus that has been mm-hmm. charged with domestic and external spying, surveillance, espionage, all that jam. From the get-go.
Today they might still call themselves Chekists within the organization. It's a name, the Cheka, that original name is kind of stuck around if you're sort of on the inside. And they, you know, there are many ways that they can get what they want. This one was a pretty interesting example here. At one point, there was a group early on in the Soviet Union's existence where they had some socialists, some anti-communists, that basically got together and they said, we're an organization now called the Monarchist Union of Central Russia. And what they didn't know is that the Monarchist Union of Central Russia was actually infiltrated by so many moles. It was a fake organization that real people joined that were socialist and anti-communist. Mm-hmm. But it was all a big setup to get them all in one place, basically root out who they were. You know, you got to know your enemy, mm-hmm. know who your resistance is. And they found who they were and they killed them.
Yeah, isn't that nuts, man? That, like, think about the effect that it has, not just in getting rid of your opposition by forming a group where they all show themselves, but also, like, that becomes legendary. Like, that's one of the
sure.
first things that this group, this security group did. And, like, it basically sends a pretty clear message, like, you can't even trust your own, the people you think that are your allies, you know?
It right.
Just, talk about sowing discord among, you know, opposition. That's just, and like, that was 100 years ago, and it still, like, can give you chills just to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, you start a group that you think is going to be battling your oppressor, and it turns out that group is so infiltrated that it's not even a real group.
Well, I got the impression that it wasn't even that they were infiltrated, but that the Cheka, or I should say the OGPU, actually started that group to attract people. You know what I mean?
No, that's what I'm saying. They infiltrated that circle.
Yeah.
And then started this fake organization.
Yeah. That's so nuts, man. So one thing that a lot of people forget, and our younger listeners might not realize, is that back in World War II, the U.S. and the USSR were allies. We weren't like BFFs or anything like that, but we had a common enemy in the Nazis, us, the U.K., the U.S., and the Soviets. And I read that from this time of basically working with the U.S. and the U.K., the USSR saw how good we were at disinformation campaigns, and it had two effects. It taught Soviets how to do these things. It basically said, hey, this is a really good way to sow discord and to get fake information out, like with your enemy. So it taught the Soviets how to do that. But it also made the Soviets think that they just presumed that the U.S. and the U.K. were creating the same operations in the USSR too. So it really kind of hardened the Soviets' enemieship of America. Like, it really kind of predisposed the USSR to be enemies with the U.S. and with the U.K. and with the West in general. And it just kind of took off from there. And just to be clear, I saw a good definition between misinformation and disinformation, where misinformation is clear where the source of the information is coming from. It's just the information is faulty. So the U.S. government is giving out like bad info about coronavirus or something like that. That's misinformation. Disinformation is where the information is faulty, but it's not clear where the information is coming from or where it came from originally. It's just popped up as like a rumor or something on social media.
Right.
But the information is faulty either way. It's just whether the source is clear, who the source is or not. That's what disinformation is.
So the Cheka are operating in World War II. They are spying on our Manhattan Project such that there's one quote in here that said they knew more about the creation of the atomic bomb than Truman did.
Yeah.
They've really infiltrated things. This gave them a huge leg up in making their own bomb and their efforts to welcome themselves into the atomic age. Like, they would have been way, way behind had it not been for their espionage efforts in there in America. There are ways that they did this. There were spies who were sort of the tried and true ways to pose as a diplomat and actually get in an embassy in a different country, but you're really a spy.
Right.
You could also, if you've seen the movie The America or the TV show The Americans, that's called an illegal when you basically pass yourself off as someone of that nation's origin. After World War II in Finland, they would find records of infants who died at birth, take that identity, and then basically become a Finnish person. It's called a legend, and you are essentially living in that country as an American or as a Finnish individual, but you are really a secret agent for the Soviets.
Right, and I mean like super duper deep cover, so much so that you can expect to go live like a pretty mundane everyday existence for years or decades as an American or as a Finn or something like that, whatever your background, wherever it says you're from. And then you might be called on to assassinate somebody one day or to start working sources. And it's not flagrant. It's not obvious. The point is that they make kind of contacts and friends with low-level people at the edges of power, how I saw it described. But I also saw that same person describe who describes illegals like that as saying that there's probably more of them in the world today than there was even during the Cold War.
That's so scary.
Isn't it scary? But here's the thing. This is one thing that I've learned about studying the KGB. It's possible there are far fewer illegals in the world today. Maybe there's zero in the U.S. But the fact is, somebody said that, and the KGB's track record is enough that it's possible that's the case.
Right. And that's what
matters. That's all it takes. Now, all of a sudden, people are paranoid. And like, wait a minute, you, Tulsi Gabbard, are you actually a tool of the Kremlin? Are you a plant by the KGB? Are you a sleeper agent who's running for president? Like, people start to get accusatory and you can't trust anything anymore. And now you're starting to see your enemies all over the place. And all it took was a rumor that there's more sleeper agents that are associated with the KGB today than there were in the Cold War. And now everybody's paranoid and the KGB's work is done for the day.
And that could simply be disinformation.
Exactly. Exactly. Because disinformation can, it takes on a life of its own. That's the point of disinformation, that it makes people behave differently than they would if they had not heard that rumor and started to believe it.
Yeah.
Because the other fact about disinformation, we should do an entire episode on it, I think, is that it has to have a kernel of truth. Like the Black Panthers have to suspect that the Jewish Defense League is or was prejudiced against them secretly. And so like these documents that were found or sent to the Black Panther headquarters just prove this suspicion that they already have or something like
right.
that or vice versa. So it has to have like this kernel of truth for somebody to be like, no, here's the proof. And then it just takes off from there because people love urban legends.
I wonder if there's ever been an army colonel named Colonel Truth.
I don't know.
All right. I think we should take a break and ponder that. And we'll come back and talk about when the KGB was born right after this.
Stuff you should know. Josh and Chuck. Woo! Stuff you should know.
And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
So the KGB, I promise to tell you, it's the when that little baby was born. That little baby was born in 1954 when the intelligence agency that had, like I said, long been operating was reorganized officially finally as the KGB with that same mission in hand. They were known as this time as the sword and the shield of the Communist Party. And if you're talking about the structure of the agency itself, it depends on who, I mean, there's a lot that we don't know, but it depends on who you're asking. I've seen anywhere from 250,000 to 700,000 people on staff, if you count the whole extended network of like foreign border guards and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think 700,000 is the most I've seen, which is an enormous
huge,
amount.
Yeah, huge compared to any kind of like CIA or any other country's intelligence organizations. The KGB is just massive.
Right. The other thing that I saw about the KGB is that you can make a pretty good assumption that just especially during the Cold War, that every single one of those agents were loyal to the Communist Party. And one way that they made sure that every single agent was loyal to the Communist Party was to basically let them know that the other members of the KGB were spying on them. There was entire sections that were dedicated to spying just on the armed forces, just on the military alone. And that was one of, I think, 20 different directorates, little divisions that were responsible for different kinds of tasks or different specializations.
Yeah, the official, like if you want to look at the official sort of charge of the KGB, it has four areas in size. It is the struggle, or an organization, I guess, the struggle against foreign spies and agents, mm-hmm. The exposure and investigation of political and economic crimes by citizens. Mm-hmm. That certainly encompasses a lot. Protection of state borders. That's what I was talking about, like the border guards and stuff like that. Right. And then this is the big one, protection of state secrets.
Right. And then, so like those are the big four, but there was another about 16 of them dedicated to everything, like making sure that the phone and radio systems were encrypted, to making sure the transportation sector wasn't infiltrated. Like the KGB had its fingers in absolutely everything. There was one directorate that was specifically tasked with surveilling and monitoring foreigners and people who the KGB suspected were potentially dissidents who were Soviet citizens. And they mostly hung around like Leningrad and Moscow because that's where most of the tourists were. But that was like a whole KGB division. That's how many people they had and how many resources they threw at keeping tabs on the power structure and making sure that any challenges to the power structure were squashed in the cradle. Not even strangled in the cradle, squashed in the cradle.
Yeah, and you know they recruited the best, the smartest people, the brightest people, but like you sort of mentioned, it's not like the KGB was something to be feared by every citizen of the Soviet Union, I think.
Oh yeah.
But joining the KGB to thwart that was not. It's not like that got you out of any sort of surveillance, or and in fact, it may have even put you under a bigger microscope. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, they had every level of the military infiltrated with KGB agents, like every platoon, every detachment. If you were in a group with the military, somebody was a KGB officer posing as a soldier.
That's right.
In their own military.
That's amazing. Yeah. By the end, I mean, I think it started, like I said, in 1954. By the end of the 1960s, it was firmly in place as the watchdog of everybody in the Soviet Union.
Right. And I mean, again, with the, like, people tend to say, like, well, the KGB was the counterpart of the CIA. But, and the CIA's done some shady stuff, including domestically. But from basically all sources, the main point of the KGB was domestic surveillance and domestic control of domestic challenges or dissent toward the Communist Party.
That's right. Spying on people, tapping phone lines, harassing people, arresting people, exiling people. If you were a religious activist, good luck. If you were a human rights advocate, good luck. If you were an intellectual, if you were just part of the intellectual sort of university system of the Soviet Union, you better watch what you say, because you are definitely being watched, and every word that comes out of your mouth, even in a classroom, is being recorded.
Yeah, and I mean, if you were super high profile, you might make it out with your life and your family might get out alive, but you would be exiled for criticizing the government. A writer named Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I even practiced that. Solzhenitsyn. Yeah. I think that's kind of close. He was actually, I think, a science teacher who started writing books about how bad things were in the Soviet Union, and eventually won the Nobel Prize for Literature. But he was eventually exiled. If you were less of a well-known person and you were critical of the government, you were more likely to find yourself in the Gulag, which is a system of prison camps that we referenced earlier. And Solzhenitsyn, I think I said it right that time.
I think that's right.
He estimated that about 60 million people were sent to those camps over the course of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible, literally impossible, to put a number on the amount of human lives lost due to the KGB. But there are people that have estimated like perhaps tens of millions of people taken out by the KGB over since its history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm no CIA apologist, but I don't think the CIA has that on
tens
their
of
hands,
millions,
you know? Which, again, I mean, we on the outside tend to think of the KGB mostly as like the spy agency. But, yeah, they kept people in line by killing them or sending them to secret prisons and making them leave in the middle of the night from their homes and never be seen again. It's just completely nuts. And the effects that has on a society is I can't imagine. I can, sadly, but I can't imagine. I've never lived through anything like that.
Yeah, and if you run an organization or a country or a nation from fear tactics from the top down, that eventually is going to bite you in the behind, because what that does is everyone's paranoid against each other.
Right.
No one, like in the case of Stalin, let's say, if Stalin didn't like what you told him, he would literally shoot the messenger. He would execute anyone who told him anything that didn't support what he thought should be going on. Like, it wasn't like, hey, Stalin, we found out some pretty bad stuff that's going on. Like, that's a good thing. That means we can root these people out. It got to a point where they wouldn't want to go to Stalin with bad news. And that's not good either.
No, and they had to go to him with some news. So what they would do, it would just kind of naturally incline toward intelligence that supported their view,
right,
rather than you know, something that said, hey, there's, you're really unpopular and there's an uprising potentially coming. They managed to squash anything like that. But in the end, this, what's called sycophantic intelligence, where it's just basically feeding you, telling you what you want to hear, that that eventually will run afoul of reality. And that's what people credit with the KGB dropping the ball on the fall of the Soviet Union back in 1991. Although, as we'll see, there's actually a lot of direct influence that the KGB had on that. But there's this idea that throughout its history, there was, Stalin kind of kicked off that thing where, just tell me what I want to hear or else I'm literally going to kill you. And that it was carried on even long after Stalin was gone.
Oh, sure.
That sycophantic kind of intelligence, which is really surprising because it was a really successful organization externally. It was that they think that potentially for as good as they were at espionage and stealing secrets, the Soviets were apparently not, and I have to preface this, let me just caveat this. This is reading American sources about the KGB.
Right.
The KGB was really good at keeping a code of silence. There were, especially toward the end of the USSR, more and more KGB agents started to defect. But even when they defected, we weren't sure if they were plants. So there was still, like, what they said was taken with a grain of salt. But the idea that that the KGB was very successful in stealing secrets supports this idea now that the Soviet Union would not have been a superpower, part of this two superpower polarity that ran the world during the Cold War, had it not been for stealing secrets, which doesn't explicitly say it, but suggests that they were, they did not have the best and brightest as far as technology and science is concerned, which is kind of a surprise to me because I'd always heard that the Soviets had really, really smart scientists in their own programs too. But this researching the KGB made it sound like they wouldn't have been able to keep up had they not stolen advanced weapon technology and built their own versions of it. I'm confused. I have no idea what's true anymore.
Yeah.
Welcome to 2020.
I think it's definitely true that their spying efforts in the Cold War, especially when it comes to nuclear armament, were very much ramped up because they were spying with us.
Yeah, but I think that they were saying, it wasn't just getting the atomic bomb, but basically like all their advanced weapons technology was the result of stealing it. And that the point is, it's kind of a two-handed compliment or backsided compliment that they were really good at stealing secrets, but that they wouldn't have been able to be a nuclear superpower without stealing secrets. I think that was what I was, that's what I found.
Well, and it also could have been, and I'm just speculating, it could have been a thing where that was such a part of the system hey, we don't need to put resources for steps 1 through 5 because we can steal that stuff.
Right, exactly.
And we can just start on step number 6 or whatever once we have whatever intelligence we need.
Sure.
But what do I know? I'm just a dumb podcaster.
Do you want to take another break?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, we're going to take another break, everybody. That's no secret.
Stuff you should know. Josh and Chuck. Stuff you should know.
Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hey, Hey, everybody. If you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
Man, what is going on?
What's wrong?
I'm making puns left and right. It's terrible.
Can we talk about spies?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
So I think we did an espionage podcast years and years ago, I think.
Yeah, spies. How spies work, I think.
Was it just spies or was it espionage as well?
Well, they go so closely together.
It's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
The Soviets were really good at, well, I don't know about really good because who knows how many times it happened. But they had some very effective moments of turning Americans into double agents. A few notable people over the years, a man named Aldrich Ames. Mm-hmm. He was a 31-year CIA officer and for about 9 years was feeding the Russians, or I guess it was the Soviet Union at that time, highly classified information from the CIA. His big thing, it seemed like, was outing CIA sources and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, turned KGB agents.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of ways. There were other people that fed documents. We'll get to them in a minute. But he was outing sources. And I think his actions directly led to, at least that we know of, 10 CIA sources being compromised and killed. And then, you know, in the hundreds of intelligence operations that he was kind of dropping the dime on.
And that's, I mean, in addition to the loss of life, as far as the intelligence community is concerned, when you kill somebody like that, you're killing like decades worth of information that the person has walking around in their head and contacts and just general knowledge of how things work. So it's a really big deal in addition to, again, killing somebody, you're wiping out like the institutional memory that they carry with them too, that's been helping out the other side.
Yeah. He is in a medium security prison in Indiana today, serving a life sentence, as is Robert Hansen. He's one that is a little more, he worked up until the, I think, 2001. Mm-hmm. And they said that his espionage was possibly the worst intelligence disaster in U.S. history. He made about $1.4 million in cash and diamonds over the years selling classified documents to the KGB. Total double agent, caught in 2001 after the FBI paid $7 million to a KGB agent to out him as a mole. Very famous case.
Yeah, I remember that as well. I remember Aldrich Ames, too, made it really easy on people. Like, he was, like, spending lavishly and was not that well off to begin with and was just being very flagrant about it. I feel like Robert Hansen was a little smarter about it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, who was the other guy? There was one other guy that basically was spilling secrets about our submarine program.
I don't know. There was a naval captain after World War II, somebody St. John. Was that in the 60s?
That was him. Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember his first name, but someone St. John, he was a naval captain. Yeah, there was a trove of KGB files from an operation from the 60s that basically confirmed he was indeed a Russian spy. Both of the Rosenbergs were indeed Russian spies. Alger Hiss, who I think went to his grave denying that he was a spy, was in fact a spy for the Soviets. So they did have a pretty good success of turning Americans into informants. So did the CIA and the KGB, apparently. But the stuff that they got was pretty useful. And again, it was not limited to advanced weapon designs, but also industrial technology, stuff that we were saying, there's embargoes on this, you can't export this. They still managed to get their hands on this because of their contacts that they turned in the U.S. Just basically anything you would want to keep your economy humming along just from stealing. That's how you could do that.
Yeah, the Navy guy, his was, he's the one that volunteered himself basically because he wanted money. It's like it all came down to greed. Mm-hmm. He walked into, I'm talking about John Anthony Walker Jr.
That's who I'm talking about too.
Okay, not St. John.
Not St. John.
He was not a saint.
Patron saint of hipsters, I don't know.
Yeah, John Anthony Walker Jr. is the one that wanted money, and he volunteered because it's not like he was a anti-American who wanted to see the Communist Party thrive. It was all motivated by greed, and he walked into an embassy in the United States with like a code card or something and said, "Hey, I'll sell you this for $3,000. And they bought it, and he was like, "And you know what? That went well, so just put me on the payroll." And he got his family involved. He had he tried to get his father involved, his daughter, his son, his wife.
His son's baseball coach, everybody.
Well, at one point, the Russians basically knew where all of our submarines were at all times because
that's
of this
right.
guy.
That's right, yeah.
And his wife was apparently a really bad alcoholic, probably, you know, in no small part due to this, and eventually outed him he was way too loosey-goosey with who he tried to get involved. Like, uh-huh. You can't try and get your whole family involved and then have them say, "No, I'm not into it," and then just be like, "All right, well, I'm going to keep doing it."
What's for dinner?
But, yeah, she ratted him out, though. She would call a bunch of times, apparently, and either chicken out, or she was really blitzed and couldn't get across what she wanted to say. But eventually she did, to an office in Boston, and they thought, well, this is just some drunk wife trying to get her husband in trouble. Ignored
it. Like a
60s
thing, I think.
Eventually, though, they did look into it, and they, you know, they searched the guy's house, and they found like briefcases full of classified documents. And it was just, this went on for 20-something years, I think.
I think, from what I understand, the most damning evidence was he had one of those Russian fur hats with the ear flaps. That did him in. So the as good as they were at turning people, at creating illegals, those sleeper agents, which may or may not be all over the world right now, one of the things the KGB has long been known for are disinformation campaigns. And from reading that guy's article, Spies, Election Meddling, and Disinformation, Past and Present, Calder Walton's article. Mm-hmm. Basically, every conspiracy theory that I believed as a teenager apparently was a KGB rumor, a disinformation campaign. I could not believe this as I was reading. It was like a trip through my formative years, basically. The idea that the U.S. government created AIDS to target developing countries.
KGB.
The idea that that American tourists used to go down to South America and Central America and adopt kids so that they could harvest them for body parts.
Mm-hmm.
KGB. Get this, Chuck. There's a poll. I don't remember when it was conducted, but it was sometime after the Kennedy assassination, where more Americans believed that the CIA killed JFK than what the Warren Commission concluded, which was that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. More Americans believed what turned out to be a KGB disinformation campaign than what the Warren Commission came up with.
That amazing.
They came up with the one that the CIA killed JFK. That was the KGB that did that. And
you know the friend of your friend's mom who was on the elevator with Eddie Murphy?
Right.
KGB.
That's right. Everything. I mean, all that stuff. Flash your lights at somebody and the gang comes and kills you.
KGB.
But it's just so bizarre to think, like, what? Like, no, I thought that I talked to people about that, like, late at night. Like, we had conversations about this stuff. And when you see that and when you read it and realize that, like, this has been going on for years, it really puts things into focus now. Like the 2016 election meddling.
Sure.
To the idea that there's like GRU agents, military intelligence agents, who are posing as members of Black Lives Matter or who posed as like Tea Party members during the 2016 election, like that they were actually working for the for Russia. The idea that that's still going on just becomes all the more clear when you look at some of their past campaigns.
Something I do occasionally. I don't know why I torture myself, but sometimes I will read comments on a FoxNews.com article.
Right.
And someone will say something, and then you can leave a comment about the comment, and someone will comment like, okay, thanks a lot, Dimitri.
Nice. That's funny.
But you don't know, man. That's what they do. They infiltrate message boards, and they infiltrate social media.
Right.
And like you never know. Like, yeah, it's staggering that this kind of stuff still goes on to this degree.
Yeah.
And there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, for real. So let's step back for a second, because we kind of hopped ahead, but I want to go back into KGB history. KGB was around from 1954 to 1991. And we said earlier that the KGB had a direct role in the fall of the USSR, and they did, because there was a KGB head who was appointed by Gorbachev because he thought that he was an intelligent, moderate person who was open to new ideas, and it turned out he wasn't. He was part of that same old KGB establishment who wanted things to stay the way that they were, and he actually led a coup against Gorbachev. I was too young to know what was going on, but there was a coup against Gorbachev where he was under house arrest for a minute.
Yeah.
And the coup finally failed because it became clear that the military wasn't in on it or wasn't going to take part in it. But it eventually led directly, within months, to the downfall of the USSR, the breakup of the USSR. Because in the meantime, they had elected, for the first time, a democratically elected president. And when Gorbachev saw that basically this coup was a vote of no confidence in him, he stepped aside, separated the Communist Party from the presidency, and all of a sudden, the USSR wasn't there anymore. It was just Russia, because these satellite states started saying, hey, we're independent now. We'll see you later, Soviet Union. And the USSR fell apart, kicked off by this coup that the KGB initiated.
Yeah, and I think Yeltsin, officially split it up, right?
Yeah, yeah. He said, KGB, you're dissolved. We're going to break you up into the FSB and the
yeah, do the same stuff.
Right, exactly. But just do it separately. I figure if I separate you guys, you might be less evil. And apparently, that was not the case.
Yeah, and apparently, not apparently, but very famously, Putin came straight out of the KGB. He was a KGB agent in the mid-1970s, supposedly because he saw a movie about Russian spies and I guess thought it was awesome.
Yeah, and said, I want to do that. There's a picture of him in one of these articles where he's in the 70s wearing like this newsy cap and just looking super 70s.
Yeah.
But he also looks like Putin, man. Just complete poker face. He's staring off camera at something. Who knows what he's taking in? It's a really cool picture. There's another picture, too, supposedly of him posing as a tourist standing next to Ronald Reagan.
Oh, my God.
Have you ever seen that picture?
No.
Oh, it's nuts. It's just so great. But then you're like, is that Putin? And I went and looked, and it turned out that there is still disagreement of whether it's him or not, but most people say that that's not him, that he would have been in Dresden at the time. He wouldn't have been in the Soviet Union.
I'm looking now. Oh, my God. That certainly looks like Putin.
Doesn't it? But the official line is that is not Putin.
With his little camera around his neck.
Right. And so Putin was not just in the KGB. He became the head of the FSB. And this is a real testimony to just how powerful the KGB and the KGB's remnants or successors remain. He went from head of the FSB to the president of Russia. That was the step that he took. And he was not the first person to do that. Other KGB heads had worked their way up to become the head of the Communist Party and the de facto head of the Soviet Union at the time. So all of this kind of goes to show you that nothing, even the fall of the USSR, really did anything to slow down the KGB. And the advent of technology helped kind of actually speed things up quite a bit.
Yeah, and if you think those murders are a thing of the past, that is certainly not the case. I remember, as I'm sure you do, in 2006, Alexander Litvinenko.
Yeah.
He was the one that was killed by the radioactive polonium-210 that was dropped in his beverage. Mm-hmm. And they have a history of doing, like, that's a really awful way to die. And they have a history of killing people in really awful ways, because it sends that message,
right?
That, you know, not only can you die, but you're going to die in a really awful, awful way, and everyone's going to know. Dating back to Trotsky, who went to Mexico City, and someone came up behind him, Ramon Mercader, with a ice axe, and sunk it 3 inches into his brain.
He said, "How do you like this projection?"
Oh my God. That was actually so bad, I think that was brilliant.
Thank you. I was hoping you'd come around to that way.
That was really good. Thanks. I got you. Mercator projection. That's lovely.
Sure.
But yeah, he killed him with an ice axe, but he lived for a day. I'd always heard the story, and I always thought that he just like planted him in the brain and that was it. But Trotsky got up and was like fighting him off, and people came in and kicked this guy's butt. And he survived in the hospital for like a full day after this before he died.
Well, yeah, Litvinenko, he survived long enough that he helped solve his own murder. There's a really great Guardian article on it called Alexander Litvinenko, the man who solved his own murder. And it's definitely worth reading for sure.
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of years ago, what was that guy's name? Skripal? Sergei Skripal?
Mm-hmm.
He was the one with the nerve poison.
He wasn't killed. It was an attempt on his life, though.
Yeah, but it was just like every time you think, man, this is Cold War stuff, it just pops up in the news again. And you're like, man, it's still happening.
Yeah, and I mean, we should say both of those attacks were in London. Like, this wasn't in Russia or Moscow or anything like that. This was in London. These guys lived in London in exile, and they were still murdered in London through like radioactive material and nerve gas that was smuggled in the country. And that actually is kind of goes to stand as evidence that there still are these illegals, these deep cover sleeper agents that are working for what used to be the KGB and is now the FSB.
Yeah, and that's why it's a really big deal that a president of the United States would want to cozy up to somebody like Putin, who is making great efforts to put who he wants in office.
Yeah. I mean, it's just pure and simple. Like,
it's unbelievable.
Absolutely, Chuck. Well said. You got anything else?
I got nothing else but rage.
So if this floated your boat, go check out Spies, Election Meddling, and Disinformation, Past and Present. It's a great article. Check out Alexander Litvinenko, the spy who solved his own murder, the man who solved his own murder. Check out The Big Think. They had a good one called The History of the KGB and Its Legendary Methods. So I think you'll like all three of those. And since I said I think you'll like all three of those, it's time for Listener Mail.
This is about the heroin lozenges. Remember that when I wondered if they were still around? So this is from Martin. Hey guys, in the heroin episode, Chuck was wondering if there are any still heroin lozenges lying around somewhere. And Josh quickly refuted, but Chuck, you have been vindicated. I work in an unnamed museum in an unnamed location in Canada. I'm not even going to say where in Canada, even though he does. And we have four different packages for heroin lozenges from Bayer. They're under lock and key, of course. We received them in a donation from a local pharmacy that closed down in the 30s. And they gave the museum a wide array of drugs to add to the collection. Along with the heroin, we also have a bottle of arsenic, and 2 packets of amphetamines. One package has 2 pills missing.
Oh, man.
Love the show. You guys are keeping me sane during quarantine. I steadily make my way through your back catalog. That is from Martin.
Nice, Martin. That was much appreciated. Thanks for shining some light on that one. And if you want to shine some light for us, we love that kind of thing. You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.